Welcome to the flyfisher.co.za podcasts. Today I'm sitting in the back of quite a well-known South African fly fishing, retail, guiding, wholesaling, outfitting organization called Frontier Fly Fishing with Dean Rapagan, who's quite a well-known South African author, written a couple of books, and we'll chat about them. Dean, how did you get into fishing?
Well, Mark, I actually started fly fishing in standard 6 when I was at school. The only reason I can remember it was the time of my life it was because I started at standard 6 because we had some fly fishing books in our school library, and that got me interested in taking up the sport. We had other books on hunting and mountaineering, but fly fishing was the one that caught my interest, and that started me off.
Yeah, I read recently that you didn't actually start fly fishing, you started fly tying before you started fishing.
Yeah, my father used to take me fishing up in the bay before I started fly tying or fly fishing, but that was before I was 13 and 6. But what we used to do is go up to the Drogsbury Garden Hotel for our annual December holiday every year.
Yeah.
And my job on various of the days was to go and catch frogs. And then my father would take me down to Lake Navarone, which was nothing like it is today. And he'd stick a fly through the rear end of a frog. And then we'd go trolling around the lake at night, because it was obviously trolling was banned, but trolling with frogs was definitely banned. And believe it or not, we actually caught a lot of trout with my father rowing and me holding onto the rod. And what a trout saw in a frog going backwards at high speed, I've no idea, but that was my first introduction to fly fishing, but not in the true sense of the word. So I got interested in fly fishing in standard 6, and before I actually got going, I saw that fly tying was a big part of fly fishing. So my folks enrolled me in a fly tying course with who was then the doyen of fly fishing in Natal, or one of the doyens, shall I say, because there were others like Jack Blackburn and another guy, Robin Fick. But Jack held fly tying classes, and that's when I first started tying flies. And so before I actually went out with my father officially, where we actually officially fished flies in the true sense of the word, where I was casting them without a frog impaled on the end of the hook.
Yeah. And from there, then you started fly fishing, obviously the bank bit.
My father, for the first 2 or 3 years, actually probably the first 2 years, my father used to go up to the Underberg area twice a year, like March, April, and then September, October again with a bunch of his mates. And they'd go and fish almost in Coolie. And I was never invited along those trips initially, but then once I started getting keen and on the sport in standard 6 when I was 13, then my father took me up there. Those mates basically dwindled away, and eventually it was just one of them or two of them, and then eventually none of them. It was just me and my father going up to up to the Underberg area and fishing.
Yeah,
look, I mean, it was very basic. I was fishing an outfit which we bought at Akles for 30 Rand back in 1979, which was a 10 Rand rod, a 10 Rand reel, a 10 Rand Shakespeare fly line. And the rod had absolutely no AFMA rating on, no length. It had snake eyes for the stripping guards. So you can imagine it was virtually impossible to cast properly, but somehow I managed to cast and managed to catch some fish.
Yeah.
And of course, we were fishing sinking lines in the streams, no upstream floating. That didn't exist back in 1979. It was all quartering downstream with a sinking line and a wet fly like an Invicta, rip back upstream as fast as you could get it, and that's the way we fished back then.
Sure. Then how did you progress then?
Well, then I started tying flies at home, and just got more and more involved. While my father was just Tom would call it Christmas fisherman, fished once a year. You know, I started fishing more and more, and I met guys at school who were keen on fishing. There wasn't actually a fishing club at our school, but I just got more and more keen on off my own bat, and started going up to the berg with guys who were a bit older than me at school that had licenses, and my folks would, you know, they would take us away and drop us off for a week, and at a place like Harmore, where we'd camp there.
Sure.
Yeah, so I kind of left my father behind, not in a nasty way, but you know, he wasn't interested in going up to the berg 10 or 12 times a year where I was. And I think that happens with a lot of guys. Their fathers get involved, eventually they just move on and do their own thing.
Now, I know you spent a lot of time fishing with Vita. How did you end up doing that?
I started my varsity career at UCT in 1987, and I was there for 3 years. And I met a guy down there called Jimmy Baroutsos. He, along with Gavin Grapes, who was then a doctor, he was a qualified doctor when I got to varsity. They had been two very keen anglers, fished together all the time. and they were the two youngest members of the CPS committee. And back then, and this is no sledge on the CPS for what it is now, but back in the late, mid to late 80s, the CPS committee was really a bunch of old guys who weren't keen to move forward, and Jimmy and Gavin kind of rocked the boat. And they, in fact, got the Vita proclaimed the Catchmere's River that it is today. Mm. And I actually went down to the Vita before that. I'd been fishing in the Western Cape during my 14 days leave in the Army. I went down. Oh, yeah. My 14 days leave actually became about a month. And I hooked up with Robin Fick, who was my mentor in Natal. And we fished the Western Cape streams for a month, including the Vita. And we initially fished the upper Vita. But eventually Robin took me down to the lower Vita, which is the stretch that I ended up fishing virtually all the time. And I stopped fishing the rest of the Western Cape streams completely. I only fished the Vita because to me it was the most challenging of the Western Cape streams. Mm. Jimmy and I used to take an afternoon off. He was doing his national service at the castle. He was a lieutenant at the castle. Mm-hmm. And he had a sport parade every Wednesday or Thursday afternoon. And instead of going to play sport, Jimmy and I would shoot up to the Elands Putt or the Horse Field. But we were catching in an afternoon 40, 50 fish each.
Sure.
Which I don't think that happens nowadays. I think with all the pressure, the fish are a lot more sophisticated. But Jimmy and Gavin had done a lot of fishing on the Vita. And the last 18 months of my degree, I only fished the Vita and only the lower part from the old hotel site at Tweedertal up to the first weir.
Yeah.
And Jimmy and Gavin had been tagging fish. And I'll continue to do that. And that was a very interesting part of learning about how the browns behaved there, because almost every brown that I caught was caught in exactly the same place over and over again. They didn't move more than, in fact, most of them stayed exactly in the same run or pool. And occasionally I'd catch the odd fish maybe 50 metres upstream in another pool or another little run. But they generally stayed in the same pool. And every time I hooked a fish, in fact, I would know exactly where the fish would be lying, because it didn't go and lie at the tail end of the pool. It would always be lying at the head or in its favourite lie. So I just stopped fishing certain parts of the pool because I knew that brown would be lying exactly in a certain place. And then when I'd hook it and it was tagged, I knew so many of the tag numbers off the top of my head that I knew exactly that fish was going to be tag number 01667, which was actually one of the fish we caught 16 times between three of us.
Sure.
So that was where I really, really fell in love with the Vita. Nowadays, of course, it's nothing like its former self, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I fished it about 2 years ago, and myself and a friend, Andrew Ludwig, saw one fish the whole day.
Yeah.
Because that was kind of my spiritual home.
Sure.
The Vita became became like my water. I looked on it as, other people mustn't come and fish this river. This is my water, this particular stretch of the river.
Sure.
And I was the only one really fishing it back then. I took Tom Lynn, my business partner now. I met him when I was at Varsity. And he didn't come fishing very often because he had a girlfriend at the time who didn't let him get out too much. And I'm not joking when I say that. It's actually the truth and you won't deny that. But when he did get out, you know, I would take him up there and we had some fantastic days. But yeah, there's definitely something's happened there. I don't know what's happened there, but it became a very special place for me when I was there because the fishing was so epic. I mean, the guys living down in the Western Cape now that have been up there would never appreciate what that river was like in the late 80s. You know, I would regularly get fish around the 18-inch mark. In fact, it would be a surprising day if I didn't get a fish of 18 inches on the Vita.
Sure.
The biggest fish I ever caught, I caught it three times, re-caught it, I tagged it the first time. Actually, the first time I hooked it, I lost it. And then I tagged it on the second time, and then I re-caught it twice after that. And it was 19 inches, and then the final time I caught it was 20 inches. And I weighed it on the final time, and it was 3.25 pounds.
Sure.
And you know, to hold a fish of 3.25 pounds in a small river like the Vita is like catching a 10-pound brown out of the Reti in New Zealand, which is a lot bigger.
Yeah.
And you know, when you look at the fish and you look at the size of the river, you say to yourself, you know, this is a really big fish.
Yeah.
And a lot of the fishing on the Vita was side fishing, which made it that much more special. I probably caught about 50% of the fish. I could actually see them lying in the current, and I put a dry fly. I only fished dry flies. I never ever fished nymphs or anything else other than dry flies, and almost always it was a beetle. I mean, I didn't really need to fish anything else other than a beetle.
Sure.
Obviously, when you were blind fishing, you'd see a fish come out of nowhere or come out of the shadow and drift up to the fly, but the other 50% of them, the fish was actually physically lying in the current in shallow water, and I could see it, and I could now good 10 hours been approached the fish.
Yeah, that's the very special fishing like that.
Yeah, look, it is a special place, and if it could, you know, if the guys down in the Cape could repopulate it with fish, it would really be, you know, something that the guys in the Western Cape can appreciate.
Yeah.
Because they don't have a lot of water to fish at the moment. Now, there's a limited number of streams there, and the Vitter, to all intents and purposes, in the low section, is not a viable fish anymore.
Yeah. Okay, so where did you move on from there?
Mike, then when I finished my degree, I moved up to Johannesburg to start my accounts articles. That was from 1990, 91, 92. And then when I finished my articles then in 92, I moved down to back down to Durban, where I'd grown up, to start working for my father's business.
Okay.
Which was an importing business, which I really didn't have much interest in, but he wanted me to get involved in the business. He wanted someone to take over, so I ended up back in Natal, which of course, it's a good thing because I'd grown up there and I could go back and start fishing all my old haunts again.
With new skills now?
Well, I really did a lot of stored fishing when I moved back to Natal, not really stream fishing, whereas in the Cape I'd done only stream fishing, a very, very little, limited amount of stored fishing.
I know that lying in the front of the shop there are a couple of boxes with beautiful stoneflies from every size, every form, every emerging pattern. I know that was a trip that you were planning to the States. Tell me about tying all those flies.
Well, what happened was, when I started working with my father, when I was actually doing my articles in Joburg, Tom was still working down in Cape Town. And I walked out of our offices one day in Jorison Street, and here was Tom and his mate walking past me going to buy camping gear, and they're about to embark on a year and a half tour around Europe. And I'd never done that. You know, when I left school, when I finished varsity and when I finished my articles, I'd never done that. I'd never got that bug out, that travel bug out of my system. So I went to my father after working for him for 2 years, and I said to him, I really need to get out of the country and go and fish. I want to go and travel around the world for a year fishing. So the plan was, I was going to go to New Zealand for 6 months, from November through to the end of April. And then at the end of April, I was going to go to the States and fish. Predominantly, I decided I was going to go and fish the western part of the United States. Mm-hmm. And I had to obviously tie a hell of a lot of flies to see me through for a year's fishing.
Sure, yeah.
So those stoneflies you see there, the very big ones are actually imitations of what they call a salmon fly, which is Pteranarchus californica, is the Latin name for that particular fly. It's a stonefly that you only get in the western states of America. Places like Montana get them, Idaho gets them, Wyoming. And I had a fly box for every single mayfly species. So I had a whole fly box for example, for Betis mayflies. I had the nymph, the dun, the emerger, the spinner. I had the spinner in male and female colours, like rusty colour, and then an olive colour for the female. I had every base covered for America. And then just before I was going to go, my father and I were involved in a car crash and he died.
Mm.
So that's why that box was full of flies, because it never actually got used.
But you did get to travel. So where have you fished?
Well, after my father died in 93, I still had that, obviously had that bug in me that I had to go fishing. I mean, I had to go overseas. And I got hold of Tom and another friend of ours, Andre Hammond, and I said, you know, let's go to New Zealand. It's the place that I'd always wanted to go. There was actually a photograph in a Kaufman's catalogue of a guy stalking a brown in a very, very crystal clear stream, and that really epitomised what New Zealand was for me. Of course, when I got there, the fishing was way better than any photograph or any book that I'd seen could ever portray to me. We actually left on the 1st of March and we came back on the 15th of April, so we waited for 6 weeks, which most guys can't do that when they're working for an employee. But I was, you know, I was working for basically for myself. I was now running my father's company on my own.
Yeah.
So Tom, myself and Andre packed our bags, hired a car, actually hired a Hiace.
Yeah.
And we toured the North and South Island for 6 weeks and had an amazing time.
You know, I can imagine.
We actually didn't really know what we were doing, to be very honest with you. We arrived in the North Island and fished a lake, very famous lake, which was going through its heyday. In fact, in March and April, when we were there, 1996, March and April 1994, was the heyday of this lake, where an average fish was easily 10 pounds, and we arrived at this lake right at the start of our trip. I mean, this is like day one or two into our trip. We arrived at this lake, which an American friend of mine who owned a fly shop in Montana told me about. And we were driving around, we didn't know where to go, and he said, no, you've got to go and fish this lake. It's called Lake Anifenua. And we didn't know where eventually it was raining, we were sitting on a bridge, making sandwiches in the car, not knowing where we were going to stay for the night. turned around, went down this back down this road parallel to the lake and saw this lodge, so Lake Anifenua Lodge. We drove in, and this man mountain came walking down out of this lodge. Now, when I say a lodge in inverted commas, because it wasn't like one of these upmarket lodges. It was a real hardcore fisherman's lodge where you slept on like a double bunk, and it was all about the fishing, not about the accommodation. And this 6'6" guy, this huge beard arrived, and he was the owner of the lodge, called Graham Ryder. And we said to him, you know, how's the fishing been? And he said, well, come along, I'll show you. And he took us, he had a shed outside, and he had a huge deep freeze, one of those things with a lid that lies flat on the top.
Yeah.
And he opened the deep freeze. It was probably, I would guess, about waist high, and maybe about 2 meters long, and about a meter wide. He lifted the lid up, and it was packed to the top with trout in tin foil that were going off to be to a taxidermist. And I think the smallest fish was 10¾ pounds, and the biggest one was about 18.5 pounds.
Yeah.
So that was the start of our trip, and we said, well, we're definitely going to be staying here for a couple of days. That was when Tom got his first double-figure fish of 11 pounds out of the lake.
Yeah.
And then we drove down to Wellington, crossed over on the ferry to Picton, and we basically fished for about 5 weeks in the South Island and a week in the North Island in total.
Sure.
But Tom, I remember distinctly that Tom caught his first, we were at the lake for about 3 days, so let's call it by the 4th or 5th of March. Tom caught his, and then we crossed over to the South Island on the 5th of March. Tom caught his first fish in the South Island on the 14th of March. So we were bumbling around, really not knowing what to do, where to go, what to look for, and eventually after like 2 weeks of not catching a hell of a lot of fish, I caught a fish every day in the streams, but the other two, Tom and Andre, Tom caught a couple of fish. Andre caught maybe 3 or 4 fish in the whole month that we were in the South Island. But that was a result of us not knowing what was going on. We didn't know what rivers were the right rivers to go to and how to even fish them or how to look for the fish. Mm. There was a guide, which the same American that told me to go to Anifenua had told me about, in a little town called Amerima. Now, Amerima is like Blickiesdorp minus 10, okay? It's a tiny little town in the sort of two-thirds right on the South Island. And he said he used a guy there called Frank Schlosser. And I phoned Frank and I said, listen, we've been in the South Island now for like 10 days and we don't know what is going on and we need help here. Have you got a day free? And it actually turned out that the following day, the Sunday, was his, I think was his birthday or the it was his only day free in like 4 months. And he said, yeah, he's free tomorrow, and picked us up and took us fishing. And he took us to the stream, which was like God's water to us. I mean, we drove in and parked on a plateau looking down the stream, and we were just standing looking at the stream and gobsmacked. And I can't say how, because you said I can't swear on this thing, but he says this is deep water. It was crap. But we were looking down this river, and it was just the most amazing stream we'd ever seen. Anyway, so we decided now he's going to take us, and we're going to fish the stream for half the day. And the rest of the day, he drove us all around the area that he guided to show us the waters we must go and fish.
Yeah.
That was my introduction to the South Island. When I went back there 2 years later with a friend of mine, I went back there in 96, 97, 98, and 99, and then again in 2004, in 2001 with Tom, and in 2004. But 96 was continued to be a bit of a learning curve, but when I went back in 97 with Mike Summerall, then we had it squared away. Then we did very well. We had very good fishing. We could see where the fish, you know, we could see fish. Because a lot of the time you're walking along a New Zealand stream, you'll see a big, what you think is a log, because the trout are so big. And you'll be walking along and you'll see this thing right tight to the bank, left, right, and bank. And it looks like a piece of driftwood that's like lying very shallow water. And there's no ways that can be a trout. And you walk up until the next minute, this thing bolts away. So after one or two trips, you don't take anything for granted. Everything that looks like a fish, you look and you study very carefully and look, it might be a log, but 9 times out of 10, it's going to be a trout lying, because they don't lie like our African trout. They do not lie in the classic runs or riffles or lies that you'd expect. They lie right out on the left-hand side, right hand side of the streams in very shallow water.
Sure.
Which obviously makes them very much more difficult to catch.
Why is that? Is that food or...
You know, Mike, a lot of streams are very different to our streams. They aren't classic streams in the sense that the Bitter is a classic stream, or the Unkamas or the Bushmans are classic streams with riffles and runs and big rocks that break the flow. And you know that when there's a big rock in the river, there's going to be a trout line on it. A lot of the New Zealand streams are unstable. from a geological point of view, it's a very young country. So you'll have a riverbed like a plain across a valley floor, which is just small rocks or small round boulders, and then you'll just have a depression, and the river's flowing along that. Now what happens is that river, because it's so young, it hasn't actually scoured down into the bedrock, will shift every year across the floodplain. You know, they have very big, they have hectic floods in New Zealand.
Yeah.
You know, what we don't have the kind of floods they have. They'll have like a flood every 2 weeks or every month. They'll have like a catastrophic flood where it rains in the headwaters and the river, it just digs a new path through the gravel.
Sure.
So in a lot of rivers, in fact, that river that I was telling you about where we were looking down on it, was a classic example of a river like that. Of course, a river like the Reti, for example, is a very different river. It's a classic river. It's scoured. It follows the same course every year. That river that we were fishing was a classic example of a river that just changes its course. You'll come there one year, and at a certain point, the river will be flowing on the other side of the valley, and you'll come back there the following year, and it's flowing on your side of the valley.
Sure.
And as a result, that there's nothing to make them really make them lie in any special place. And I guess they probably lie on the sides of the river because the flows, it's less of a battle to lie in the water and battle the current.
Yeah. Well, you've obviously then fished a lot of other places like Seychelles and Europe, States, South America, etc. But moving on to your books, and how did you get into the first book, and how did you start off? Why did you write that book?
I've always loved writing. You know, every article I wrote for the Complete Fly Fisherman, I always said to PJ, you know, don't pay me because this is not about the writing. The first article I ever wrote was for Fly Fishing Magazine. I wrote a good couple of them, and I always said to Dave Rourke, rather give the money to FOSAF. You know, it's writing for me, I love writing. I love writing about fly fishing, not anything else. So never a financial incentive to write the book. I just wanted to do something and put something back into the siren flashing industry and help guys who were coming to sport, you know, and didn't really know what to do or what flies to use. And that's the first book I wrote was published in 1998. But I actually started taking photographs for it when I actually had a mental picture of that I wanted to write a book. I actually started taking photographs in the last year of my degree at UCT, and I was actually fishing with Eddie Herbst on the Vita and taking photographs and knowing that somewhere down the line I'd be using those photographs. So 9 years before the book was printed, I was already starting to shoot photographs and to build up a photographic library for a book that I had in mind. And when I moved up to Johannesburg, I met another fanatical fly fisher, Angelo Comas.
Seems everybody knows him.
Well, I fished with some very, very talented anglers in my time. As a novice, the guy that taught me, that took me under his wing, was Robin Fick. I mean, he was leagues ahead of anybody else that I fished. As Tom would say, he just got it. He just understood what fly fishing was about.
Yeah.
And the two other guys that I fished with in my lifetime in this country, that to me are head and shoulders above anybody else in terms of, they might not tie the prettiest flies, well, the angler ties a hell of a good fly, but Fred Steinberg and Angelo Comas are, without a shadow of a doubt, the two most competent anglers that I've fished with. They just get what is required when you're fishing a stream, which is the real test of how good an angler is. When a guy can manipulate the line, you know, mend the line in the water, knows what flies to use, what weight flies to use, where to cast the flies, those two guys just get it. And Angelo is definitely one of those guys.
Yeah. So you were saying that you came up to Joburg to do your articles, and then you met Angela.
I met Angela, and so we're getting just to get back to the book. When I met Angela, he was working in Laxness, what was then Laxness, which is a very different Laxness to what it is today.
Mm-hmm.
It was on the downstairs level, and they had a car radio place next to him. And Angela was fanatical about his fishing, as fanatical as anyone can possibly be. So naturally, Angela and I took to each other because we were both mad about fly fishing. Angela had a couple of books in the shop, and one of them was Randall Kaufman's Tying Nymphs. He's actually got two books, Tying Nymphs and Tying Dry Flies. And I like the format of his books, the way he'd lay them out. He had, you know, the tying sequences of the flies, and then a little story about the history of the fly, or an anecdote where he caught a big fish or something interesting about it. So I based the layout of that first book that I did on Kaufman's books. I think it'll be quite interesting for guys listening to this to know that there was a Supreme Court case involved in my book.
Yeah, I've heard briefly about it.
When I went to my father with this concept of doing this book,
yeah,
he said to me, well, both of us being so naive about how books were published, He said, well, why don't you get the guys who published my catalogue to do it for you? So kind of to cut a long story short, I went to them, gave them the material, gave them all the patterns in sequence, mm-hmm. and then all the flies like the ones I'd taken of Eddie and all over Natal. And they laid the book out. The intention was to do the book in black and white with only a small section of colour photographs, mm-hmm. like you'll often see in old books now. Now, mm-hmm. obviously, they can print books in full colour and it's not that expensive. So they went ahead and they laid the book out and they actually did a shocking job. And then they started printing the book without my consent. So they actually went and virtually printed all the pages. They had these reams and reams of paper in their warehouse. And the book was an abomination. I mean, that they had got the sequential photographs back to, like, number 15 was in number 14's place. It was a mess. So we refused to pay them. And I was then about to leave and go on my years fishing around the world. So they had me arrested. The sheriff of the court actually came around to my office, and I had to give him my passport so I wouldn't leave the country. And they had got me arrested on a Supreme Court arrest order called a tantum suspectus de fuga, which is easier to get than going to the magistrate's court. I had to give them my passport. And then the guys who'd gone ahead and printed all the pages of the book, they thought we were just going to settle and pay them. But they'd gone ahead and printed the book without my consent or anybody's consent. So I said to my father, let's go and fight them in court. We'll go and fight them in the Supreme Court. So then my lawyer said to me, well, you know, Dean, this thing's you'll be lucky if you get a Supreme Court date in 3 years. So if you want to go overseas, you can go overseas. I'll go to the judge, and with the proof that you've got a return ticket, so you're not leaving the country with no intention of coming back, you are coming back in a year's time, and then you can fight. And I said, you know what, let's fight this thing right now and get it over with. And I arrived at the court with my advocate, and the advocate arrived, and he hadn't been briefed, and they actually thought we weren't going to fight them, so they settled. So we paid them a nominal amount of money to get my photographs back, which was the main thing.
Yeah.
But in hindsight, that is a very good thing, what happened, because a lot of the flies, because then it took another 2 or 3 years for me to sit down, and then I had to reshoot all the sequential photographs because they made such a mess, and they bent some of the, because this is the days of trannies, so there was no digital photography back then, they bent a lot of the trannies, so I had to reshoot all the files again, all the sequential photographs.
Yeah.
But it then gave me a chance to get, you know, newer, more contemporary paints in the book and throw out some of the old ones.
Mm-hmm.
And without a shadow of a doubt, the best thing about it was that I had we had to go and pick up all the printed material.
Yeah.
It was like on pallets, so you can imagine it was a lot of material. But I could then go and show Strake in Cape Town what I had in mind. So I flew down to Cape Town, and I went to see them. And Strake are the definitive company to deal with if you want to do that kind of book, like a coffee table high quality book. And obviously now I had all this printed material, so I could go and show them. And I went, managed to see the publications director, a lady called Linda de Villiers, very super professional woman and a very professional organization to deal with. I flew down there with all the reams of paper, well, not the whole palette, but enough copy to show them what I had in mind. And they came back and said, no, you know, we're keen to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And you asked how about the sales. I think it'll be very interesting to the guys listening to this podcast that a South African bestseller, a non-fiction bestseller, is a book that sells 3,000 copies. Now, that doesn't sound very much, but that is the benchmark. And my book, that first book, has sold, I think, 16 or 17,000 copies. So it immediately went onto the exclusive books bestseller non-fiction list. Within the first month or two, because it sold so well. And I think it's been reprinted about 4 or 5 times. They've stopped printing it now. But
well, we want to do a little poll and see if there's a market to reprint, because we know that the minimum print is, what, 1,000?
Yeah.
So
we're actually looking at it. You know, I've got hold of the one because we have so many people coming to the shop looking for the book.
Yeah.
And I actually had to. I never had a copy. Now, I printed 25 leather-bound copies, which I gave to, like, my mom and Tom and good mates of mine. Mm. And then I didn't even have a regular copy, the normal copy that was issued. And, you know, this is now, I think I bought it this year or last year, and ended up paying 800 Rand for it.
Oh,
for a book that was selling at 149 Rand when it came.
Your own book.
Yeah.
So then how did you do the Stillwater Trout in South Africa? So where did that move to? How did it progress?
Well, once I'd done the first book and when it had been the success that it was, you know, then I decided, well, now let's do another book, you know. And it started off as a book that was going to be about streams and stillwaters all in one. But the copy got so large, because the printers will say to you, all the copy can be 60,000 words. And this thing was already like 100 or 110,000 words with the Storda and stream element. And because I was doing so much Storda fishing when I'd moved back to Natal, it was obvious that I had to split the book to do a stream book and a Storda book. And it was natural that the first book I would do would be a Storda book, because I had so many photographs of the Stordas I'd fished all over the country. And, yeah, and I'd obviously, you know, I had photographs of lots of big fish, because I'd caught five or six fish over 10 pounds in the period that I moved back to Natal. And well, they obviously went down to the Western Cape and caught one or two there in the Eastern Cape. And I had mates who caught some very big fish. So, you know, and everyone wants, obviously, a Storda book. Guys don't want to see 2 pound fish in a Storda book. They want to see big fish. And I had those photographs. So that was the natural step to take, was to do that book first. I wouldn't say I've shelved the book on river and stream fishing, but that Storda book took me so long to write. It didn't take me long to write. What took me so long was to photograph the insects. And, you know, at the time that I was writing the book, I had the time to take off from my work in Durban and go up to the Swartberg and spend 10 days. And while my mates were spending 10 days fishing, I was spending 5 of those 10 days capturing insects and then photographing them alongside the water.
Mm.
You know, you can't bring insects back from the berg down back to Durban and expect them to live very long, because obviously the water's going to get so warm, they're going to die, and you want live insects, not insects lying on their side or all curled up and dead. So I had the time back then. Obviously, a book on stream fishing would require me to go and travel all over the country and capture all the insects, and it wouldn't just be the nymphs. Then you've got to capture the nymphs, and you've got to photograph the duns, and you've got to photograph the spinners.
Yeah, but
it's a major operation.
Yeah, but that's because you're too... Oh, what's the word I'm looking for?
Anal. Well, you've got to be, you know. You can't. I couldn't go and write a book on Storda fishing and include half the insects and just leave out half them, because I couldn't. I don't know. I didn't have them to photograph. I had to photograph every single insect that was relevant to Storda fishing. And the one that really stumped me was getting the Bates's mayfly, because they only come out at a very short time of the year. They're not there, not on the water all year round. So, and I was starting to run out of time. Now the publishers wanted to get the book going, and they wanted the photographs. And I was starting to panic because I couldn't. And then eventually I went up to Waterford, I sneaked it. And I found the red dock, the slate one, and the pale sulphur one on the same day. And I managed to photograph them alongside the water in a white saucer, and it was all squared away.
Sure.
But you can't, I could never go and do a book on stream fishing and not include every single insect. Your major ones are obviously things like mayflies and caddisflies. And, you know, mayflies don't hang around on trees and wait for you to come up with a thing. They see you coming and they fly away. Or they're on a rock, like on the Western Cape, and they jump away and they scamper away, or they run away off the rocks. They're very difficult things to photograph. Ted Forsiglia, who's a very well-known photographer of particularly mayflies, actually captures them and then puts them in his freezer at home. And when they start getting frozen and they just stand still, then he quickly pulls them out and takes them out. Well, they haven't fallen over and aren't dead from being frozen, but they are incapacitated because they're so cold. That's the way he photographs them, because they won't stand still, most of them anyway, for very long. And, you know, my dragonflies, the dragonflies that I photographed in my book, you know, and I was, bearing in mind, I was shooting on film back then. I was shooting on slide. Digital was very, very new, and digital SLR cameras were very expensive.
Mm.
So I would bracket the shot. I would shoot like 4 stops up and 4 stops down to make sure I got the right exposure. And what you're doing is you've got this macro, like vertically over a dragonfly, for example, and you're about to take the photograph, and next minute the thing blasts itself out of the saucer or to the edge of the saucer. So what I did was I stuck a pin into the top of the dragonfly's head to kill it, but not to kill it completely, just to incapacitated it so that it would sit there with its legs out properly and not with its legs all withdrawn like that it was properly dead, because they just won't sit still. And likewise, the little canis nymphs, they also don't like to sit still. They like to swim around. And the little betas, the little minnow mayflies, they also don't like to sit there nice and sedately and wait for you to take photographs of them. As you're about to take the photograph, you'll swim out the frame. And you know your neck's getting tired when you're perched over this bloody camera all day. So it's a big exercise doing a book like that.
In film, that must be an expensive exercise.
Yeah, and you know, then you've been up to the berg, you've caught the insects, you've brought them all out under Durban, you've shot them as quickly as you can, get them in the fridge. Then the next day, I'd take a day off work, I'd sit there and I'd photograph them, and then I'd bracket them. But then you also got to, you know, shooting an insect with a macro lens, your margin for getting the thing out of focus is very, very easy.
Mm.
Because what you have to do is if you focus on the back, his legs are more than likely with a macro lens going to be out of focus. So what you actually got to do is you've got to go somewhere in between the, where the legs are on the bottom and the shellback is on the top. And you've got to go halfway so that everything is in focus. So what you do is you then take the film off to the guys who are going to print it or develop it, and you get it back, and you could get the lighting wrong,
yeah,
or you could get them out of focus. And then you've got to go back to the bag the following week, capture the insect again, and reshoot it. So it's now, obviously, with digital, it's infinitely easier. Mm. You know, and
has that changed photography for you as a person?
I mean, it's changed photography for the whole world.
Yeah.
You know, it's made everything. You can blast away, you can shoot 100, you can shoot 200 photographs a day in the Seychelles, and if only 20 of them are good, you just dump them. So look, it would be a whole lot easier to do another book like that, Stored a Book, and the insects would maybe take a little, it would be a little easier to get the insects, but either we'll then have to take, you know, I've only got so much lever here. It is a granddad runs a very tight shop. But yeah, you know, we get 20 working days leave a year, and you make the most of it. And, you know, 20 days leave a year is not enough for me to go into the whole country and catch all the insects. That's like a 5-year operation where you would just be going around the country catching insects to get the insects you need.
Sure.
So it's a big exercise to do a book like that. But it'll be interesting to see whether the guys want a book on stream fishing or ribbon stream fishing, because it would just apply, the techniques would apply. It wouldn't be a book on trout fishing, it would be a book on all rivers and streams, which would encompass yellowfish and all the mending techniques and how to read a river, you know, all that. It wouldn't just be about the entomology.
You know, you started speaking about New Zealand earlier, and I was quite enthralled, and you so much information. In the South African Fly Fishing Handbook, you've got a lot of photographs of the Eastern Cape. You spoke about the Witte and the Western Cape already, and you spend a lot of time fishing with Fred.
Yeah.
Anything particular that you can tell us about the difference between fishing Eastern Cape, Western Cape, and Mpumalanga and Natal streams, concentrating on streams to start with?
Look, the Western Cape streams are very, very different to any of the streams in the rest of the country. There's a lot of it's mainly fast flowing water. There are not a lot of big long pools like, for example, you get in the Mgani and the Natal. So it's a lot of pocket water fishing where you, as Tom Sutcliffe says in his writing, you dust the riffles with a dry fly. You know, to go to the Western Cape to me and to fish in them, yeah, you can do it, but I mean, it's you can get the fish to come up and rise. The waters are very acidic there, they're not very fertile, so the fish are not just concentrating on subsurface food forms like nymphs or pupa. They definitely look to the top, as specifically to terrestrial insects, which makes up a big part of their daily fare.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the Natal, if you fish a dry fly all day, you're not going to get a hell of a lot of fish rising to your dry fly. The Eastern Cape is kind of somewhere in between. You can catch a lot of fish in dry flies. I mean, you could go to Boardman's Chase on the Bell and fish a dry fly all day and catch a lot of fish. But I said you wouldn't go to Natal River like the Bushmans or the Mkumasi or Mgani and fish a dry fly all day, because there's so much food, sub-aquatic food, that the fish don't have to look to the top for a big portion of their food. So the Western Cape is a very, very, very different prospect to the rest of the country.
Mm.
The Eastern Cape streams and the Natal streams and a lot of the streams up here in Mpumalanga on the half elch are very, very similar. You can fish the same tactics.
Yeah.
You can fish dry. If you see a fish rising, obviously you're going to fish a dry fly to it or an emerger, whatever it's depending on what the rise form looks like. But to a large degree, I would be fishing nymphs all day.
Yeah.
Getting down to the bottom. The water's a lot heavier in a lot of those, a lot deeper and a lot heavier than a lot of those Natal rivers, where the fish are just not going to come up to the top in very fast water.
Mm-hmm.
We're in the Western Cape, I would never ever consider fishing anything other than dry flies in the Western Cape.
Yeah.
You know, I haven't fished down there for a long time, but the guy says that it's definitely changed. And just bear in mind that when I was at Varsity, and I fished, obviously I went down to the Cape after I finished Varsity, but when I was at Varsity, there was no pressure on the Western Cape streams. You could go off the Eland Spot on any day or any weekend and never expect to see another angler on the river. Now, with so many guys fly fishing down there, you've got to book a beat ahead of time. The fish are a lot warier and a lot wiser. It's no different to how the fish have changed on the flats of the Seychelles, or on the rivers in New Zealand, for that matter. The fish have got wiser in New Zealand as a result of angling pressure,
mm-hmm.
a lot warier. A lot of the big fish that I used to see in 94, 96, 97, on rivers like the Ahuriri and the Areti, those big fish, those big 10 and 12 and 14 pound fish, They just don't come out during the day anymore. You will not see them. They sit in undercut banks and they're pretty feet at night, but they don't come out because the minute they come out, there's going to be an angler walking up the river and is going to pound them with a fly. And the same things happen in the Seychelles. The numbers of GTs at places like Cosmolita on the flats has definitely dwindled compared to what it was 2 years ago, which is, in the grand scheme of things, a very short period of time. They get to know that the minute they come onto the flats and there's people there, they're going to get pounded, they're going to get things thrown at them, and worst case scenario, they're going to get hooked.
Mm-hmm.
So they've changed their feeding habits within 2 or 3 years. I think the guys at Fly Castles will even tell you that there's definitely been a change in the feeding habits of the fish and likewise at Farquhar. The feeding habits of the fish in the Western Cape have from what I gather and what I've heard from guys who lived on there, the fish are a lot wearier and a lot wiser, and the guys are fishing much smaller flies. Back in the late 80s when I was varsity, you could just put on an elk and caddis and snatch their living daylights out of the fish. They would come up and rice that thing, there would be no problem. And now I think that the guys are fishing much smaller patterns, much finer tippets. You know, we were fishing 4 and 5X tippets. Now the guys are probably fishing 6 and 7X tippets. The fish have wised up because they are getting fished to virtually every weekend, and obviously the more hardcore guys are taking a day off work or just bunking work and going up to the rivers during the week. And the fish are, just, it is the way that things are. They are going to get...
Yeah. Well, I mentioned in a previous podcast that I battled through Bormans one day. It's the first time I've ever battled through Bormans. When we went and investigated, it had been fished every day for 2.5 weeks solid before that.
Yeah.
And the fish just did not...
And you know, and what you've got to bear in mind is that I first fished Willow Roads in 1997. And look, that to me is the finest piece of water in the east, in the Rhodes area.
Yeah.
But there was no pressure. I mean, it's not like you had to, you know, in fact, I don't think there was even a beat system back then. If there was never a rush to get to Fred and say, listen, hey, I need a book Borman, because there was nobody fishing. Rhodes is just, they're building an airstrip there. It's going to change the whole scenario of how easy it's going to be to get down there.
Yeah. Touching on that, if you want to fish Rhodes before it becomes commercial,
Now's the time to get down there.
Yeah.
But look, and there are a lot more people going on there. I mean, the village has changed in 10 years. It's nothing like it was when I first went down there 10 years ago. It's like Dullstroom is nothing like it was 15 years ago. You know, it's like it was a little door 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And there's more and more pressure. Even in a place like Rhodes, which is a 7.5-hour drive from Joburg, there's a lot more pressure down there. More anglers going down there, and more anglers fishing. So you want to go and book a beaten Boardman's, you best get up early in the morning and go and put your name down for the next day.
Yeah. I think we've done more than enough on trout. Tell us a bit about Seychelles and some of the saltwater stuff you've done.
I went to the Seychelles with Mark. I'll never forget when we were on the rubber duck going on to coming through, basically through the cut in the coral onto the flats, standing on the duck. And you could see the bonefish. You know, I'd read Dick Brown's book and tight flies from Dick Brown's book and read Kaufman's book on bone fishing. And I just remember when, even from coming through the waves, I could see the bones just all over the flats. And it was chaos. I mean, you could catch 30, 40 bones in the morning. Now the guys that have been here recently say it's not quite so easy. You can still snatch the bones, but it's not like a 30 or 40 fish in a morning or in an afternoon session, but it's still very, very good.
Mm-hmm.
And then the following year, in January or February, I went down with a whole bunch of guys. I went down with Tom, Keith Wallington was with us, Alan, Tim had a fantastic, we did I think it was a 2 or 3 week trip where we went down to St. Joseph and then went on to Alphonse, just before they built the lodge. We were one of the last sail away boats that could actually fish around Alphonse. We didn't know very much back then. We were fishing offshore with 10 weights instead of 12s and fishing what we thought were big offshore flies, fishing like 1-0, 2-0 clouses, when you should have been fishing like 4-0s and 6-0s. But it's all a big learning curve, and you learn pretty quickly. I think we caught 2 or 3 GTs on the trip down at Alphonse. There were no GTs on the flats at St. Joe, but we caught a couple on the flats at Alphonse. But we only fished at one very small part of Alphonse, and it's a hell of a big atoll. So, you know, we didn't get to see the northern part or the western side of the atoll at all. We fished on the eastern side. And we now obviously take trips there. It's part and parcel of our retail fly shops business. We take tours down there. We guide tours to Cosmolita and Estove. Still good destinations by any stretch of a man's imagination.
Yeah.
But as I said, the fishing has definitely changed. The fish are a lot wearier to come onto the flats. And then recently we've obviously Tom and I went on a recce trip down to a lake in Argentina, which was, I mean, you know all about it.
I've seen the pictures.
Crazy fishing, yeah. We between six Africans and two Finnish guys on the trip, we caught 1,260 odd fish, averaging sort of 10 pounds, maybe even a bit better. I didn't even fish the first day, so the numbers would have been a little bit higher. But I was getting out of bed, you know, that some of the guys were getting, the two Finnish guys were fanatical. They were just pounding the water from sunrise to sunset, and it's a long day, you know, the sun comes up at probably 5 in the morning and goes down at 10 at night. So you can fish all day, and if you did actually fish all day, you probably could turn and fish a day without trying too hard. But I was getting out of bed at sort of 9 in the morning, getting onto water at 10, fishing till half past 12 and then having lunch. Then everyone has a siesta in the afternoon, and then I was getting back on the water from, say, 2 to 5 in the afternoon. So it was like 5 hours of fishing. Mm. And I was getting probably 60 to 100 fish a day.
Yes.
In fact, my left bicep on the end of the second day, which was my first day's fishing, was actually sore from pulling fish.
Yeah.
You know, that's how many, I mean, it was basically every second or third throw, you'd go tight in the fish.
And these are just monster fish. What makes it so impressive?
Well, it's privately owned, so not every Tom, Dick and Harry can get there, number one. It's a hell of a schlep to get there. It's a 7-hour trip to get there by road.
Is after you've been in flight for...
Well, this is after you've flown to Buenos Aires and then overnighted there and then flown three or four hours down to a little town called El Calafate, right down in the south. You know, you're 2,000 kilometres north of the Antarctic. So the water at this lake never gets warmer than 5 degrees Celsius all year round. And you can imagine what it's like in winter. We were there in midsummer. You definitely don't want to walk around there without waders on. You'll get frostbite on your feet if you have to walk around the lake all day. It's a very, very alkaline lake, a lot of weed beds everywhere. And the only food source that we found on the fish were scuds. Which is, for those guys who are listening here and don't know what a scud is, it's a freshwater shrimp.
And they were thick.
Yeah, there's two species, and there's a Gamara scud and a Hylella scud. Those are the scientific names. I'm not sure which one they were, but there was some of them were like a burnt orange colour and some of them were an olive colour.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all the fish had in them. They had nothing else in them. We actually had to kill two fish. Prior to lunch the one day, one of the guards, there's three or four Argentinian guards based permanently at the lake. They said to us, "Why don't you guys quickly just go down to the lake and catch us 2 5-kilo fish, which is an 11-pound fish." And we went down, and on my first throw, I think I had a fish about 9 or 10, but he said, "No, that's not big enough. Have another throw." And, you know, within 5 minutes, I think we had two fish off that were the size they wanted. And we obviously gutted them to see what they were eating, and they were just absolutely jam-packed with scuds. And the reason flamingos' feathers are pink or orange is because they eat shrimps or, you know, crustaceans.
Mm.
And these fish had the most amazing flesh. It was like a Columbia sportswear orange shirt. That's bright, bright orange. The flesh, without even being cooked, was bright orange. It was amazing. And I mean, I'm not a big lover of trout as a food. You know, I've never ever ordered trout in a restaurant. But let me tell you, I wanted to go back for seconds and thirds.
So
we actually should have killed 3 fish of 5 kilos because I think everyone, we flattened those 2 fish and the guys are still hungry.
Yeah.
So they're just amazing. The biggest fish they've had there is 28 and a half pounds, but that wasn't caught on fly. That was caught, the guys were trailing, I think, a Rapala or something.
Yeah.
But the biggest fly to date caught on fly was caught actually this year in March of 24 pounds. The biggest fish we caught in our tour was 18 and a half, but I watched Tom battle a fish for probably half an hour. And the hook eventually pulled. The fish got stuck into the weed and pulled. And that fish was well over 20. I mean, who knows how big it was. But, it's an absolutely amazing venue.
Okay, we're going to wrap it up quickly. Let's do the quick fire favourites. Dry fly.
Mike, I would have to say any innovative foam-bodied hopper pattern, like a bar hopper dropper, the hopper that John Barr ties, or any... I mean, if you walk into an American fly shop and you see the innovative... salmon flies tied with extended foam bodies. Well, I'd say that to me, my favorite dry fly would be a nice hopper, like a grand hopper. Rainey's grand hoppers was a great hopper pattern.
Okay. Favorite nymph?
Definitely a flashback nymph.
Favorite rod?
That's a no-brainer. Sage TCR 9'5" weight is the best fly rod I've ever fished in my life.
Venue? Could be a place in the world or Vita.
My best venue my best venue locally would the Vit and its heyday. Stored of fishing, definitely, I won't mention any names, but a private venue in the Swartberg area of Natal.
Yeah.
But beyond a shadow of a doubt, the best place that I've ever fished in my life is New Zealand. The South Island streams of New Zealand are just absolutely mind blowing. And I will be going back next year if you'd like to join me.
Please. Favorite species?
Trout, definitely.
Technique?
I like nymphing, Mike. I know a lot of guys would say dry fly fishing, but I like the three-dimensional aspect of nymphing. And I've seen it too many times in a place like New Zealand where we've thrown dry flies at fish and they won't come for them, but the minute you put the nymphs over them, they'll eat the nymphs. So I just like the tactile aspect of nymphing and the fact that there's an aspect of depth involved which you don't get with dry fly fishing.
Gadget or gizmo?
I'd have to say a Sims retractor, pigtail retractor would probably be my... The bit, they don't break. Unlike those other round zingers with a metal spring in them, they don't break.
Favourite movie?
Oh, that's no brainer. A River and Cedars.
But a lot of these...
I don't say A River and Thread because it was never a movie about fly fishing. Fly fishing was just an ancillary thing to the whole movie. What I liked about it, it's a kind of movie that I'd end up crying about. You know, when the son dies and he gets beaten up in that pub and he goes across the border into Idaho, I think, and he gets beaten up. It was a movie more about family values. And fly fishing was just something that they did. But the movie was not a fly fishing movie. It was a movie about family values. But obviously, because it had an aspect of fly fishing, I would definitely say The River Runs Through It was the best movie that ever regarded fly fishing. Way better than Running Down the Man or Trout on Diaries to me, because of the fact that it involved people's values.
Favourite author?
Guys listening to this probably have never heard of him, but my favourite author of all time is Ernest Schubert, beyond a shadow of a doubt.
Why?
You've got to read his books to understand why I consider him. He's dead now. I think he died last year, the year before last. But if you read his books, absolutely superb writing. I think also the first magazine that I ever bought, fly fishing magazine I ever bought, was a Fly Fisherman magazine, American Fly Fisherman.
Mm-hmm.
And Schubert had written an article on stoneflies, on the Pteranarcissus californica stoneflies. Now, in looking back on his writing, he writes quite flowery prose, but the guy's just so well travelled. You've actually got to read like some of his books, like A River for Christmas or Remembrances of Rivers Past. And you understand why he, to me, is the best fly fishing author.
Okay, favourite book? One of his?
Not one of his. My favourite book of all time is another guy who people will never, particularly young anglers, never heard of. A guy called Charles Ritz, who inherited the Ritz Hotels. He wrote a book called A Fly Fisher's Life, which was a book in our school library, and I think that's probably one of the reasons why I've got such a fond recollections of reading it. But I used to read that book probably four or five or six times a year, every year when I was at high school.
Sure.
And he was so far advanced. That book was so far advanced for its time. You know, he was so way ahead of his time. He invented the whole high-speed, high-line casting technique, which is how we all cast now. You know, back casts are all high and fast. He was the one that put that into writing. So definitely he would be, that his book would be my, and it was the only book he ever wrote.
Okay.
The first half of it is a kind of a technical how-to book on how to fish for trout and grayling in Europe,
mm-hmm.
and there's a couple of photographs from America. And then the second part is all his remembrances of all the fun he had on fishing during the war, just after the Second World War. And I mean, this guy fished everywhere. He's like Schwiebert. I mean, this guy has fished everywhere in the world.
Sure. Interesting sightings in a river.
I'll tell you a sighting that was made by in a book which I read, and then I'll put that into context for this thing. Gary LaFontaine, the late Gary LaFontaine, and a guy called Mike Lawson, who ran for many years the Henry's Fork Angler in Idaho, they wrote a book called Fly Fishing in Henry's Fork. It's like a how-to manual. It gives you all the descriptions of the breakup of the river and the fly sheet. Anyway, Mike Lawson was fishing with Rene Harrop, who's obviously known as a very famous angler. And they got separated, and Harrop ended up a couple hundred metres upstream from him on the Henry's Fork. Anyway, Lawson hooked a fish, and it popped him off. I think he was fishing a size 20 merge or dry fly, whatever it was. And a couple hours later, he hears Harrop screaming and shouting and waving to him to come and take a photograph. And he's holding his net up with his fish net. And like, you know, Lawson's looking at the fish from a long way off, and he's saying, "Oh, the thing there looks maybe 16 inches. What's the big deal? Why does he want a photograph?" So he gets up to Renee, and Renee had also been fishing a size 18 or 20, but the amazing thing was that Renee's fly had hooked, gone through the eye of Mike Lawson's fly that he'd lost on the fish a couple of hours before. I mean, the odds of catching that fish again, yeah, I've seen that done in a day where we've lost a fish and caught it in the store and caught it again and again, in fact. But to hook that same fish but through the eye of the guy's fly, and it's a size 20 or 18, is just the most amazing thing. And it just goes to show you that trout and fish across the board are not the most intelligent things on earth. Now, we give them far too much credit. But probably the funniest thing that I saw, the most strangest thing I saw, was when I was fishing on the Eglinton River in Fiordland National Park in New Zealand with Mateman and Mike Somerville. And normally what we'd do is every fish we'd sight, one guy would fish for it. If you duff it, the next guy fishes for it. And you'd rotate the strike. But we got to a stretch of the Eglinton where there was a high bank on the right-hand bank looking upstream, and there was a shingle bank on the left-hand bank. So Mike said to Mike, right, you take the shingle bank, I'll climb up onto the high bank on the right-hand side, and I'll spot the fishery, and you fish for all the fish. And there were about, I think, if I remember correctly, there were five or six fish in the run. And I had a video. Now, if I hadn't videoed it, and I didn't show you the video, you'd never believe this happened. But Mike, I think the first four fish, he landed three of them, or the first five fish, he landed four of them. And then we came to the last fish, and it was lying just ahead of a tree stump in the middle of the river, rising furiously. So Mike put on an Adams, pitched it upstream, and the thing drifted down. Brian came up, nice fish, not huge, but maybe 4 pounds, ate the dry, and the thing popped him off. But now he's probably dragged the fish down there, fought the fish downstream for maybe 30, 40, 50 meters from where it was lying. So I'm standing on the bank then, that's game over, that's the end of that. So I'm standing there watching on the bank, hidden amongst the trees, and this fish swims back to its lie, and it starts rising, like, straight away. So I said to Mike, you're not going to believe this, that fish is back in its lie, and it's rising again. So he puts another Adams on, and he throws it upstream, and the fish comes up and eats the Adams again. And he plays it downstream, and it pops him off. So I think, well, that's it. The fish goes back up to the same lie and starts rising. He puts another Adams on, and he comes up, and it eats the Adams for the third time in like 10 minutes. And he plays it this time for about 2 minutes, and then it pops off, and then it decided, nah, I'm going to disappear. But you can imagine some guy catching that fish the next day with the three Adams that all look the same, especially by the same guy in its mouth. I mean, that is just crazy.
Yeah, unbelievable story. All expenses trip anywhere, and this is probably your hardest question.
Yeah, no, very, very difficult. New Zealand, South Island.
How long?
As long as I could go for the rest of my life.
Thank you, Dean. Really appreciate it.
Pleasure, my boy.
They say you know life is given, but I tell you now, it's all within that river. You find yourself in the heart of heaven. Close off so long, you could swim forever. One place to rest your grace, the silver sands lead the way. The water's golden stories told, free clouds, sapphire summer days. Fun way to spend your day, take yourself deep right away. Drive 6 hours and walk 5 days.